This is tape 2A of an interview with Craig Brown on the 4th of May 2002 in his home in Bremerton, Washington. We were talking about Raytheon being in the polar business and having a polar division that's run out of Denver. Anyway, you went to the Arctic.
That is correct.
Somewhere back there. Where?
In 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And the object of that was we had prepared 24 Mark 46 torpedoes. And we ran, 12 of them were, I'll call it the Mod 2 variety, and 12 were the Mod 5 variety. And the objective was, A, to see how they would perform under the ice. And, the primary objective was to see how they would perform under the ice.
Mm-hmm. Was this classified at the time?
At the time it was classified.
It's not now?
As far as I know, it's not now. The fact that we had torpedoes on the ice was what was classified.
Yeah.
And but as far as I know, that has been declassified.
Is this Star Wars? Star Wars guys?
It was Naval Ocean System Center. Yeah, which are now Spa Wars.
Yeah.
Can I get you more coffee?
You'd get me some more coffee.
How about you, Brian?
I'd love some more. Thank you.
Sure.
Let's see. This is tape 2. What's that one? Okay, so you went... Where did you go? What was the name of the station?
Well, it's called Atlas. It's all I know. It's about 140 miles north-northeast of Prudhoe Bay. That's where we ended up.
Atlas.
Yeah. On the ice.
Applied Physics Lab, APL, over here at the University of Washington.
That is correct.
LIS.
Yes.
And what year was this?
1986.
And was the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory involved at Point Barrow?
Not. It could be, but I don't know.
How did you fly to Atlas? Out of Prudhoe?
No, we flew from here to Fairbanks by commercial airplane. Then we flew on a old DC-3 up to a Dew Line station. And all of a sudden I could get my ball cap and get it to you.
Oletuk?
Huh?
Oletuk?
No.
No. Wasn't Prudhoe.
No.
Okay.
And then on a little Twin Otter from the Dew Line station up to the camp.
Mm-hmm. How far was it offshore?
Well, I think they said it was about 140 miles.
Okay. So you were over the continental shelf.
Supposedly 12,000 feet of water.
Mm-hmm. That'd be more than 140 miles out. Long continental shelf there.
Okay, I don't know. All I know is that we were out in the ice somewhere, and they told us there was 12,000 feet of water, so if I drop a wrench, forget it.
12,000 feet of water, and it's Atlas. Wasn't a number on it? 1, 2, 3? Atlas.
I know it was the only one that was going that year.
Probably one.
Yeah.
Did you take torpedoes with you?
Yes. We took up 24 torpedoes.
24. They weren't in that otter with you.
Huh?
They weren't in the otter with you, were they?
No. They came up. They didn't go specifically with us. They were shipped, you know, by the Navy, and I don't know exactly how they got there. But no, we were never there at the same time. We didn't travel with the torpedoes.
Did you fire these torpedoes there?
Yes,
we had
a big tent, and they'd cut a big hole in the ice for us. The ice was 12 feet thick, and we had a launcher that dropped the torpedo down into the, well, held the torpedo until it got down below the ice.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd get pointed the right direction and release it and it'd drop, and then a lanyard would pull, and then it would start up and and start running.
What kind of torpedo?
Mark 46.
Mark 46?
Yeah, lightweight torpedo.
Six. How much do they weigh?
About 500 pounds.
Were there explosives in them?
No.
Just
these are all exercise. All exercise.
Cement, huh?
We just had an exercise head, recorders, and then lead droppers to make them come up at the end of the run. You blow some lead that fall out. And
yeah, but you had to have something that was the weight of the normal propellant.
It's about the weight.
Yeah. But I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, it's close, but it's not exactly the
now, what
same.
What month was that?
Well, it was
March,
end of March and into April.
Yeah. That's the favorite time to go.
Because I know we had to get out of there by like 5th of May or something. It was going to start breaking up, and we were off there before May, but the camp had to shut down then.
The best flying was in May actually, but it gets too soft because the sun's shining.
Yeah, but anyway, that particular year is probably somewhat a function of the year. But that year they said they were trying to get out of there by the 5th of May.
Yeah, well they have to. In fact, the guys are back now, and I'm hoping to pick a couple of them up on this trip. They're up on ice. New to Agard. Tell me, who ran the station? Who was the guy who ran the station?
Well, that's what I don't remember.
Jumper Bitters? John Bitters?
No, it seemed to me like it was Roberts or something like that. And unfortunately, I didn't really...
Yeah,
if we get down here and I go do a little looking, I can maybe get that information. I just don't have it with me right now.
I was just curious.
Well, I have it. And I just didn't prepare for it right now, but I don't remember at the moment.
So, anyway, how'd they work?
Well, we had 24 good runs.
24 out of 24?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to help claim credit because I was responsible for getting them ready. So,
okay. It
was a lot of work getting everything ready for that. So.
Shirt sleeve weather?
No. It was about, getting down to about 40 below at night when we got up there. And mm-hmm. by the time we left, it was getting up to around zero.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you de-acclimated for that cold stuff.
That's the South Pole. Yeah. It doesn't take very long, it seems like.
Yeah. So tell me about the ice station. What'd you live in?
Well, we lived in a tent. Mm-hmm. And there was 6 people in this tent. One guy lived in we had a big Quonset hut type tent. But that was our work area where we had the hole cut in the ice to launch torpedoes through, and where we had all of our torpedoes and all of our equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And but then they had these little tents that were probably, I don't know, 8 by 16 or not real large tents. Mm-hmm. That were pretty much where people stayed. So we ended up staying in those tents.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a stove in them, so they were fairly comfortable.
Did they have huts for buildings out there?
Well, they'd come up and build things out of plywood.
Yeah.
And I don't know where they burn them or what they do with them.
They'd
haul off what they can. And
use sure. Eskimos? Do you have some Eskimos out there?
No Eskimos. Now, the thing that was kind of interesting, the fall of 85, I had to go back to New London and take a ride on a submarine. Because we'd had a sonar nose on the front of a submarine that was going to go up under the ice and collect some basic data for under ice performance. And I'd met a guy who was running, I don't know what he's running, some gear for mm-hmm. somebody else on that submarine. And then one day I'm walking through camp, and here's this guy walking through camp. He had been on a submarine, he'd gotten off the submarine, and he was going to catch a plane and go home. But
did you have a submarine?
Yeah, we had a submarine that we were shooting at.
How did you get the torpedoes back? Did they come up under the ice?
Yeah, after at the end of a run, they blow lead, so now they're buoyant. They come up under the ice. They've got pingers on them, and we had a 2D tracking range. So they could go out and say, well, they're about there, and they go drill a little hole and put another little sounding device through and really isolate them. And then they'd go out and melt a hole in the ice, and the divers go down and hook attachment gear onto them. Then they'd go and hack it to a helicopter and pull it out and go carry it and drop it off near the tent.
So you had helicopters, what, Huey? Bell?
I think Bell.
Yeah, Huey. Beautiful. It's going to be around another 50 years up in Model. I used to come up there, too.
Okay.
Up in 76.
But anyway, it worked out well. The obviously the Mod 5, which is a newer version, worked better than the old Mod 2, which is the older version, and they ended up putting Mod 5s into captor mines, which originally had the older version torpedo on the captors.
And, what's a captor mine?
It's what?
What is a captor mine?
Well, a captor mine is a mine that has a torpedo inside it, and they drop it, and an anchor comes down, and then the mine will float at whatever depth they set. They let us off so much anchor wire, and then the mine's all awake, and if it sees a submarine, then it'll release a torpedo to go after the submarine.
So you could use them as a barrier if we went to war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was, that's how you'd get under the ice. You'd have to submarine and have to launch them and place them under the ice because they wouldn't go through the ice very well.
Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever test trying to drop torpedoes through the ice?
As far as I know, nobody's ever tried that. As far as I know, that year up there, they were dropping something to see how it'd penetrate the ice. But since everything was classified, you really didn't, other than you knew something was going on. You
compartmentalized into your own work.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were up there the spring of 86.
Yeah.
And that's north of Prudhoe Bay. Okay. How long were you out there?
Well, I think we were on the ice about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you came back here?
Came back here.
Involved with the polar work?
Not after that. Not after that.
Writing up papers or anything?
Nope. Nope.
How about the museum I see at the Keyport? I haven't been there.
Nice museum.
Undersea Museum.
And they got a lot of torpedo and Navy history stuff there, and they're trying to expand it beyond just Navy history. But my wife had worked in the gift shop for a while until she got too involved with caretaking.
Yeah.
And probably that's one of the things next fall I'm going to do is go out and volunteer at the museum and, help with displays or do something to that extent. But they've got a good library. It's a pretty good museum.
Got a polar section to it? Or
no specific polar section.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do have polar. Does it have anything to do with polar and any of the displays, the work that was done up there?
Not at the moment, not that I know of.
For all the submarines that went up under the ice.
Yeah.
I've interviewed Admiral Steele, Anderson, who was the skipper of the Nautilus.
Okay.
And Admiral Calvert was the first to surface at the pole. And we've had an awful lot going on since 1957 when they first went up there.
Well, did you ever talk to, and I can't remember the guy's name, Nosk, who was in charge of the Arctic labs down there?
Waldo Lyon.
Yeah, Waldo Lyon, yeah.
Old friend. I worked with him.
Okay.
He died. We nominated. I was going to do an oral history on him. Nominated him, and he was accepted as an honorary member of the American Polar Society. Incidentally, I've got some magazines from the Polar Society. He joined with the likes of Byrd and Perry and others. Quite famous. But I did interview Eugene Lafont, who was his counterpart. Eugene had ride us up, and Waldo would ride us up. But between the two of them, they made all the big original trips in the experimental days.
Mm-hmm.
So, Waldo, I'm going to go way back. Go way back with Waldo.
Well, I never had anything to do with him, but since I worked at NOSC, it seemed like he was always getting some kind of a headline, mm-hmm. so you'd see him in the paper.
Well, I worked with, actually about Walter Monk. I worked at Scripps, and half the guys at Scripps had their unclassified life at Scripps, and they had a desk at NOSC. Some capacity.
Mm-hmm.
You've been to the north, to the Arctic as well as the Antarctic. How do you compare the experience of being on a continent with floating around on an ice floe? By the way, did that floe move while you were out there?
The flow did move, and I really couldn't tell it other than when we were dropping the torpedoes in the water to get. Sometimes you could see that there's like a current underneath, which was obviously you moving probably rather than the water moving. But, and they had a pretty good storm that we moved a lot during the night or whatever, but basically we did not know that we were moving.
Didn't break up flow?
No.
Any of the ice around you? Did it have pressure ridges or anything?
No.
It's a pretty docile time of year.
Yeah. But the other thing that was interesting, though, is that they identified this area where you had to go out and break ice to get our fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody identified the blue ice. You know, I guess they call it the blue ice.
Yeah.
But on the Antarctic, you knew you were in a mountain of snow
you weren't going anywhere.
You weren't going to go anywhere. And, of course, then you knew you were going to be down there a lot longer. And there was more permanent structures and everything more permanent. Well, this was just temporary duty. But in both cases, you know, I had a good time at both places. And the thing that was nice about the Arctic duty was, A, there were no telephones. You were up there for one purpose. It was fun helping the girls in the mess hall do the dishes. And
you had some women out there.
Yeah.
That's a big difference in the Antarctic when you were down
there. That's right. And then we'd go take turns helping pump fuel into the various fuel tanks around the camp. But so you had things to do to be generally helpful if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it was just good. It was sort of reliving my Antarctic experience in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wondered how I survived 110 below zero when I thought 40 was really pretty chilly. But,
well, you'd acclimated.
Yeah, I know.
That's funny. But did they have any briefing for you? What happens if the ice starts to crush? Anything like that?
Not really that. Now, the only thing is that before we went up there, we went out to Maine to a SEER school and spent a week doing some survival training.
So you'd been to SEER school?
Yeah. But, I mean, we weren't put through all the things that pilots are. We just went through the stuff to kind of help.
Cold weather SEER. Yeah. Cold weather SEER. It's not like one San Diego prisoner of war camp.
No, I don't think so. Well, I guess this one can also be out in Maine could also be pretty severe for the pilots. But for us, they were pretty nice.
Yeah.
But the other thing,
that's Navy SEER or Air Force SEER?
It's Navy. Well, Navy. As far as I know, it's Navy.
Okay, Navy SEER.
And up in something Maine, I could go find the name.
Yeah.
And then the thing that was interesting, though, we had to go out and we had to basically live outside for a week. We got there Monday, we went out, and then Friday evening we came home.
So this is in winter.
Yeah, this is in December. And it was pretty cold, so we, of course, we had parachutes, everything. That was our, kind of the material that you had.
To live under a parachute.
Yeah, and the idea was if, in case on the way to the Arctic, your plane went down and you had to survive till somebody could come get you. I mean, that was the object of the training.
Here's save that parachute.
Do. Yeah. So, but interestingly enough, on the last night, they did have a cabin there where they held classes, and I mean, it was a house. And they volunteered to let everybody come and sleep inside. And after we'd been sleeping outside, and it just seemed too hot and claustrophobic, we ended up sleeping amazing. After 1 week, we were pretty well conditioned to the outside temperature, and the inside was just too hot and claustrophobic. So ended up sleeping back outside in the tent, or in the parachute.
And that was in preparation for your experience up in the
Arctic.
In May.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, neat. When you flew over the Arctic, did you see much open water?
Didn't see any open water.
It was frozen all the way from the shoreline out.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's in May. Now they're having problems with open water.
Well, they're, well, okay.
Of course, they blame it on global warming. Not a cycle.
Yeah.
So, so it was different. You had women. You were moving about. You knew it. There was a nice flow. Question on the ice flow. Was a multi-year flow?
How thick
was it?
Could not begin to tell you.
How thick was it?
Where our tent was 12 feet.
Okay, it's multi-year. But
depending on where you were, I mean, like the torpedoes would go out and sometimes they'd have to cut through maybe 3 or 4 feet. I mean, they'd always look for a fairly thin area to cut through.
Well, you have a mixture of a thick flow and a thin flow. Ice will grow 8 to 10 feet in 1 year if it starts growing in October. But then something opens up.
And then the submarine.
Anything over 10 feet is, you freeze some the first year, you melt off 2 feet in the summer. and you freeze some more on, and pretty soon it gets to be maximum about 20 feet. Can't get any thicker with Arctic conditions. It insulates, it grows. And so you're on a multi-year flow, which two things. It's thicker and safer, and it's also harder because it freezes out salt.
Well, I was under the impression that one of the keys was they had to find this blue ice for water source with one key that they had to...
That's a multi-year flow.
Okay.
That freezes out the salt. That mm-hmm. takes a number of years, though. So you had some pieces there, at least, that had blue ice.
And then the submarines, when they'd service, they were over there looking for something like, I think they wanted 3 feet or less if they could get
it. Yeah, that would be a refrozen leaf, and that's annual ice.
Okay.
And if you're going after torpedoes, you don't want to have to drill through a thick flow.
No.
Well, I chopped a hole through a 20-foot thick flow, but we were putting a station out that was supposed to be there for a year, which was. It was there for 10 years after we abandoned it. We'd see it
just keep sitting about, and moving around.
Huh? And that took some doing. And it was really hard ice.
Well, what they did, I don't know, they used that hot water
thing.
Is that the way you did it? Or
No. We had to dig it in those days.
Okay.
Something new. The hot water's new.
No, the hot water system was going to work really well.
Well, but still, it's easy to go through a refrozen lead, which is 3-4 feet thick. And that's what you put your runways on, because they're smoother. The older ice doesn't melt.
Oh, okay.
And the surface doesn't melt evenly.
Incidentally, before I got there, though, a C-130 had landed at the ice station, which is apparently the first time a C-130 had landed at on one of those ice stations.
Not true.
Huh?
Not true.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, that's what we were told, anyway.
Was the Navy sailing there?
I cannot. All I know, that was supposedly the story we heard, was that this is the first time they'd taken a C-130 to land.
I landed them there in 1975, and it wasn't the first time then.
Okay.
And we did them routinely. We built the whole Ajax ice camp system. We had 120 people living at sea year-round on 4 stations, and we supplied them all with C-130s.
Okay.
And once the heavy airlift was done, we did the personnel movement back and forth with helicopters and twin otters. But it's amazing how people claim records and things.
Yeah. Well, anyway,
like this gal at South Pole and the coldest temperature of plane landing down there. Air Force made all these claims, so we've been doing that routinely for years.
Well, I know, actually at the South Pole, I got in on the first, on a plane, I think right after I got there, a plane landed and it got quite cold, and I remember going out and we put JATO bottles on the side of it to get airspeed so it could take off. That only happened once while I was down there, but I was involved in putting JATO bottles on.
Were they backloading stuff?
I can't remember. It was, shortly after I got down there. And
see, usually they came in the South Pole full of stuff, usually fuel.
Yeah.
They pumped the fuel off or dumped the cargo or whatever.
The Wonder Arch or whatever.
And then hardly anything came out of there.
But it was cold.
We started hauling back cats to...
Well, the problem was it was cold. I don't think they had so much on there. Apparently it got colder than what they'd wanted.
Well, you got more lift.
Yeah, but I...
Got more power to the engine.
Yeah, but I was under the impression that you didn't get the friction on the snow, so a lot more drag.
Well, yeah, they forget the techniques. What you do is you taxi down where you're going to take off, then you take off in your tracks.
Okay. Well, I know they only did it once.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was doing other than they needed help putting these JATO bottles on, and they needed some muscle, so I was there for some muscle.
I've seen all kinds of claims of records for stuff that we used to do as routine surfacing lately, with the Air Force taking over, because they didn't know what the Navy did, so they make claims to doing all these things down there, the Air Guard. And but see, C-130s the T-3, which was Ice Station Zebra, if you like.
Yeah.
In 71, I flew in there on a C-130, my first time, 70. Doing research, postgraduate school. So it was routine operation by then, so I don't know how long they've been doing that. Air Force landed for Arliss, Ice Station Alpha during IGY. They landed out there on a refrozen lead with a C-124.
That's
a lot bigger than C-130.
That was a Shaky Jake, wasn't it, or something?
Shaky Jake. It's on wheels. And basically unload the station. So these records.
Yeah, okay. Well, after that, they use CASAs, though, to resupply everything else within the little CASA.
Yeah. Well, the C-130 is so great, you can land on the skis and the footprint is light. Where, you know, that's it was more of a feat to land at C-124.
Yeah.
And it's a high center of gravity because you're up on high landing gear. That C-130, basically, you're almost landing on the fuselage.
Yeah, there's not a lot of room between them.
No, it makes it very stable where you can't, you know, if you hit something, you can't close up or flip over. Wonderful piece of equipment. Again, Joe Fletcher up here at SQUIM, he's first got into the development of skis for the R4D to land on the ice, to build ice stations and what have you. And he recommended the Air Force, when they developed the C-130, that they asked Lockheed to be able to make it compatible for skis from the very beginning. And he built T-3 ice station Zebra, if you like, for the movie.
Yeah, the movie.
So he's still alive. Uh-huh. I didn't stop to see him because I couldn't get away. Snuck through town. So it's unfortunate you have to do that, but I wanted to get to you and I want to get some other things done. So,
well,
anyway, I think
down on to your left, that was see those helicopters? That was supposedly, from what I'd heard, the first time helicopters had been to the South Pole, February 4th, 1963.
That's correct.
And then they...
Frank Radmiller, right down in Texas.
Well, they flew them in and they tore them apart and took them out in C-130.
That's true. They were working about 250 miles away at the southernmost outcrop of rock in the world with this George Dimani, who's an Arab originally. He's now one of the grand old men of the Antarctic, advisor to Congress and all that stuff on Antarctic and Arab affairs.
Okay.
He's Christian, and he's been married to two or three different blonde-haired, blue-eyed.
Now just a picture of Sestergy.
Yeah, you don't want to land on that.
That was pretty rough.
That's the trouble with open-field landing.
Well, I remember once they had, you know, we basically had a whiteout. And a guy landed, and he's out there tooling through the antenna field. He was So, fortunately, didn't get entangled in anything, but he certainly wasn't where he was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's happened a number of times in the fog, ice fog. Now, this is a picture of you in a USARP jacket.
Yep.
Picture of the roar at South Pole.
Yeah.
C-130 on the skiway at South Pole.
Yeah.
Lucy, Charlie Brown, and Snoopy we talked about before.
There's the Dobson building, and then that panel in the middle is where we released the weather balloons, and then one on the right is the Aurora Tower.
And that's South Pole where the flag is.
Yeah.
Did you guys, did you survey the pole flag in?
No.
You didn't. Okay.
It was
do that
in midsummer. We knew it wasn't super accurate.
But it moves 32 feet a year. Move. Station moves.
Yeah, it's pole eventually get in the water, right? Someday you'll be in the ocean.
32 feet a year.
Is that right? So that station, if I wanted to go visit my old station, how far do I, or how, is there a marker on it?
A mile.
Can it be identified?
They can take you down in your old station, and the one that was original before the original, Goody Goodmanson built stuff. Just to make a story, I stayed down there for a couple weeks once, and this guy and I figured out how far it had drifted since Amundsen was there, and we went and took a 100-foot marker tape and in hundreds of feet went out. It was a little over a mile, as I recall.
Wow.
And
a lot of repeats, wasn't it?
But we were walking and pulling a banana spud, and we put a tent up right on top of where Amundsen's tent was, and I spent a night there just for
golly,
doing it. But I have a picture. Every year they survey it in accurately, and it's only good for the moment. And they put a pipe in, and they put the flag in it. Well, you can see the pipes from years before lined up in the direction it's all drifting.
Where is it drifting toward?
And it's drifting toward the dome. It still hasn't got there. It would go under the dome.
But I don't know where the dome is. I mean,
but, I mean, toward what continent? The pole, the dome is drifting towards the pole because okay. they built it on one side. But it's drifting to come out and drift down and sort of split, half of it go to that general flow of ice to the Weddell Sea area down to the Filchner Ice Shelf.
I got to go over here.
Yeah. I'm going to close this out and okay. we can talk about it. This is the end of an interview with Craig Brown. It's been very good. And I appreciate that, Craig. Thank you.